It is April 14th, 1936. It is chilly enough to wear an overcoat. Gathering at the Lafayette Theater at 131st, 132nd Corner, 7th Avenue, Harlem, is an excited crowd wearing fedoras, and some people are in fancy dress. There is also a vehicle pulled up with a motion picture camera on top, taking this as if it's the launch of an aircraft carrier. There are mounted police present. The crowd is excited and all looking at each other, looking at the opening of the doors. This is the premiere of a Macbeth by William Shakespeare. It says so on the marquee. The Lafayette Theater has been here since 1913. It's been the scene of many gatherings of excited theatergoers, but nothing like this. What is most striking to see the photographs today, they're everywhere, is that it's a black and white crowd together, and this is 1936. And that in itself is an achievement. I welcome the author of a book that explains that scene and so much more. The Playbook, a story of theater, democracy, and the making of a culture war by Professor James Shapiro. He is the Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. And he's going to take us into that moment, and then we'll roll back a little bit and where it starts, and we'll roll forward a little bit and say how it's with us today. Jim, a very good evening to you. Congratulations for the Playbook. That moment, those photographs, they're everywhere. What do you see when you look at that moment in history? Good evening to you, Jim.
Good evening to you as well, John. A pleasure to be speaking with you again. When I look at those incredibly vivid and powerful images, I think of one of the great moments in the history of American theater. I think of it as one of the great moments in Harlem's history. I think of it as well as one of the great moments in the history of Shakespeare in performance, all rolled into one. And there are thousands of people gathered in the street, as you said. There's a marching band playing. The advanced publicists were not allowed to spend money publicizing the production in print, so they had taken chalk and marked up every street in every direction leading to the theater the previous day. And the crowd was gathered to see a production by an untested 20-year-old director with a cast of 150 black actors playing Shakespeare's great tragedy, Macbeth. No one knew how this would turn out. Everyone was eager. They had heard the noises and the drumming from the theater for 11 weeks before this. So there was great excitement. And as you said, there were both blacks and whites. This was also a great moment in the history of integration of blacks and whites in America as early as 1936 in an age of Jim Crow.
Harry Hopkins, born 1890, died 1946. Immediately, everyone recognizes, oh, that's FDR's legs. That's the man who goes to Moscow. That's the man who transfers an enormous amount of material to the Soviets to fight the Second War. No, it's right now we're meeting Harry Hopkins as a man who worked for Governor Roosevelt when the Depression hit in New York, and then moved to Washington to also work for now President Roosevelt with what becomes the Works Progress Administration, although it started out as with other names. Inside that, Harry Hopkins vouchsafes hurry up, urgency. This is our hour. And in particular about one part of the relief that the Roosevelt administration will follow through, because it had started under the Hoover administration, is Federal One. What was Federal One, Jim?
Federal One was a way of putting artists, and under that rubric I would include painters, historians, actors, writers, and musicians, putting them to work. Harry Hopkins is one of the great forgotten Americans, and he deserves far more credit for helping this country in an hour of need. He was one of the very few men who were trained as a social worker in the 1920s and early 30s. And when the Depression hit, he had worked for the Red Cross. He had worked in New York State. He had worked on a large scale. And he understood that if you put people back to work, you had to put them in work that suited them. In other words, you don't take a violinist and put a pickaxe and a shovel in her hand or his hand and say, dig a ditch. You put a fiddle in their hands and you said, entertain your fellow Americans. And by the time he got to Washington and been put in charge of the WPA by President Roosevelt, he had understood how to make this work on a large scale. Federal One was an opportunity to create five organizations for musicians, for painters, for theater artists, for writers, and for historical researchers, and put them to work. And the jewel, the crown jewel of Federal One was the Federal Theater Project, which employed at its peak 12,000 theater workers, actors, directors, stagehands, and the like.
We need to establish also something, that there's a tradition of theater that's been lost here in the 21st century. And you spend a deal of time talking about the theaters across America before Hollywood and before the big push of Hollywood, which happens after the First War, after the end of the Great War. That those theaters, were they empty by the 1933-34? Was it a wasteland, Jim?
It's hard to imagine today an America in which every town, small or large, held theaters. I'm talking about states like Nebraska, Montana, states that right now might have one or two theaters, had scores of theaters at the end of the 19th century. Theater was the American pastime in the late 19th century. And in the early 20th century, it peaked and movies took over. And by the 1930s, the triumph of Hollywood was almost complete. All those small town theaters had been turned into movie houses. All those local theater groups, which were a kind of cultural glue that held communities together, had been destroyed. The movies were less expensive. They had their own stars and they swept America. And by the time the 1930s came around, the number of unemployed actors was enormous. Actors could no longer work unless they were lucky enough to be in Hollywood. Even a large percentage of Broadway's theaters were shuttered and dark during the height of the Depression. So these were dire days for anybody who wanted to go to theater or create theater.
And now Harry Hopkins has a choice. He needs somebody to direct the Federal Theater Program. And his first choice, Elmer Rice, says, no, but I've got an idea. Introduce us to Hallie Flanagan, born 1895, also a Grinnell graduate. Who was she, Jim?
She's the real star of my book, somebody I knew very little about until I was able to read her great book, Arena, which is about the Federal Theater, and also go up to Vassar College, where her archives are, read her, basically her diary or her memoir that remains unpublished, and understand her relationship to Harry Hopkins. They were at Grinnell at the same time. And Harry Hopkins didn't want to pick a New York producer or a Hollywood type to run this Federal Theater. He knew Hallie Flanagan. He knew that she was a professor at Vassar, one of the first women to win a Guggenheim Prize. She had gone abroad in the late 20s to study theater in Europe and gone everywhere, had met everyone, had gone to Scandinavia, England and Ireland, Germany and Italy, and especially Russia, where there was very exciting theater work being done. And she came back greatly excited, set up an experimental theater at Vassar College, And if Harry Hopkins had not picked up the phone and called her, probably would have spent the remainder of her life as a tenured professor, training generations of Vassar women to go into the theater or to make theater part of their lives. But Hopkins called her up, said, come to Washington. I want to talk to you. She reached out to everybody she knew in the theater. Elmer Rice was the only one who gave her advice. She went down to Washington, and Harry Hopkins said, I'm asking you to direct this federal theater. No one could imagine what a federal theater was. There was no federal or national theater in America. Everything was really individual, and nothing had been supported by the government until this time. And what Harry Hopkins and the Roosevelt administration had committed themselves to was considering the arts, much like industry or agriculture, as deserving of federal support. Many no longer think that. Many are violently opposed to that in our own America. But in the 1930s, that was a consensus view. And it allowed both Republicans and Democrats in Congress to authorize Federal One and to set in motion the creation of a federal theater. But nobody knew at the time how many unemployed actors there were in America, where they were, whether you could recreate in various parts of the country what had been so vibrant just decades earlier. And it turned out that you could do so in 29 of the states. So Hallie Flanagan set about, in a matter of months, to employ 12,000 theater workers, set up theaters across the nation, and get in gear what would amount to, in the short 4.5 year life of this theater, 10,000 productions in these 29 states, seen by one out of every four Americans, which is mind-boggling to me, who paid a pittance or nothing to see these plays. And it wasn't just in theaters. There were trucks that pulled into city parks and started staging plays there. They sent performers to entertain those who were digging trenches, who were building trails in Colorado, who were immigrant communities who needed plays in German or Italian or Spanish or Yiddish. This was a massive enterprise.
The book is The Playbook, a story of theater democracy and the making of a culture war. Harry Hopkins, Hallie Flanagan, and now we need to go to Harlem to explain that scene, because that's a hit. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.